imagination. It is an area which we call the Twilight Zone.
But today we call it White Aryan Resistance Radio Network, and here I am, Terrible Tommy, in the bunker here on a Moonsday morning. Yes, and this is, what is today? Ooh, this is the 1st of February. Let's see now. When's Groundhog's Day? That's my mother's birthday. I think Groundhog's Day's pretty quick. Maybe tomorrow. I don't know. But April Fool's Day is going to be played again. Yeah, or played prematurely tonight. You got your popcorn ready? Your homemade beer and your hooch? You get to see the carnival. Going to the animal fair. The birds and beasts were there. The big raccoon by the light of the moon was combing his auburn hair. You ought to have seen the monk. He jumped on the elephant's trunk. The elephant sneezed and fell on his knees, and that was the end of the monk. Yeah, they're all going to be out there tonight, every last crazy politician. And I might be able to watch a little bit of it, but not very much. I'll tell you, it's so bad, this stuff. I'd rather watch reruns of The Twilight Zone. Actually, X-Files, yeah. Trouble is, I've seen, I think, every X-Files show that was ever put on TV, so it's hard for me to find one. They got some new ones out now, but you got to pay for them, and I'm cheap. And I'm still at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581, and our website is looking fantastic. Going up there to resist.com, it's beautiful. The webmaster has done a tremendous job getting things together up there, and she's still got a little work to do, but it's good to know we're in there. We're there. We had a few mysterious unidentified calls. Your website's down. Your website. What's going on? And these are either guys that hate our guts or guys that are hoping that something happened to us. Yeah. But anyhow, and then there was some legitimate questions on the subject too. Well, it's going to take a hell of a lot more than they've thrown at us so far to get us down. I don't know whether Stormfront's up or not. I don't pay much attention to the right wing, but I know they said it was down, and who knows? I've got to keep track of these websites and these right-wing radio shows. Yeah, right. Okay. Well, I see that 30 or 40 Chinese miners were trapped underground over there in China recently, and they got several of them out. But the interesting part of the story was the owner of the mine committed suicide, threw himself down a mine hole or something, which shows you a little bit about honor that some people have that other people don't. Evidently, he did something wrong, and he was in shame, and he took his own life as an honorable thing to do. You never see one of these guys down in West Virginia in that big coal mine and all that stuff. If they ever, they do stuff wrong all the time. They have hundreds of charges against them for, you know, and there were 30 or 40 miners was killed down there, not too many years ago, and they just not too long ago the court denied them hardly any money either, the widows and children of these people. I think it would be good if those owners of those mines committed suicide. What do you think? Well, I guess this mosquito virus is floating around, is already in the United States. There's no cure for it. And they don't look for research even to start until 2017. So guess what? I wonder what how many people that's going to knock off. Maybe if it's virulent enough, it'll be in the big cities where the bigger population of non-whites are. Who knows?
Building a pipeline dedicated to moving North America's dirtiest fuel through our communities, we should be focused on what it will take to make America the clean energy superpower of the 21st century. So what do you think, Governor? The pipeline, is it a good investment or bad investment?
It's a horrible investment, because if it was going to be used for us, why would they have to bring it to the Gulf of Mexico and put it on ships? This thing was going to go straight west through British Columbia. British Columbia would have nothing to do with it. They didn't want their environment screwed up. They didn't want the danger of it. They said no. So then they decide to go straight due south, and they get all these people that owe the oil companies big payoffs for getting them elected to start selling us that somehow this will create jobs for us. It'll be a wonderful thing having this pipe running right across one of our major aquifers. You know what an aquifer is, right? That's clean water. We need a lot of it today. Ask California. So now they're trying to do the sell job that we would benefit from this thing. This is nothing more than the oil companies having a mechanism of getting us to pay for it, us to maintain it, so that they can load up the oil and sell it to other places around the world and continue making billions of dollars. We need to take this money and go to clean energy, and I agree with Hillary Clinton. Let's be the country that's known for progression into the future, not looking back to the past, to an old ancient energy that ought to be getting rid of right now.
Well, according to PolitiFact, oil industry experts and the U.S. State Department agree that, quote, American refineries would be the primary buyers of crude oil transported through the Keystone XL pipeline by a vast margin. Also, the State Department's report on the Alberta, Canada, the Steel City, Nebraska crude oil pipeline also found that it would not significantly contribute to carbon pollution, at least in terms of, you know, the ways that they're already transporting it already. But there has been much debate about the issue of jobs. Proponents of the Keystone XL state that it'll create thousands of jobs. Soon to be former House Speaker Representative John Boehner wrote, "The nearly 6-year delay in approving Keystone is costing Americans more than 100,000 jobs." But the truth is less than half of that. The State Department estimated 42,000 jobs would be created in the short term, but only 35 permanent jobs would remain for inspections, maintenance, and repairs.
There you got it. So it would be like building the stadium for the pro football team. Yes, initially, all the construction workers work. They build the big monster stadium. But once the stadium's built, the amount of employees drop dramatically, and the ones that are there are usually working for minimum wage. And that's what you got here. Oh, yeah, the building of the pipeline would create a lot of damn jobs. But once the pipeline's built, goodbye jobs, you're back in the unemployment line. And what did they say, 35 people just to maintain it? I would think it would need more than that just for the security of it. Wouldn't it be a target for terrorists?
You know, there's this idea of short-term construction, and what would be a better investment in our short-term construction would actually be our infrastructure. According to a 2013 report by the American Society of Civil Engineers, our own infrastructure is a mess. They rated it a D+, suggesting $3.6 trillion was needed to invest to bring us up to a suitable grade by 2020. That's $3.6 trillion. That's about 2 Iraq wars, right, Governor?
Yeah.
I mean, would this be an easier pill to swallow if we measured costs by military spending?
Yeah, I think that's a great way to do it. It's the price we've paid. We need to fix our infrastructure for the tune of 2 Iraq wars. That's what the Iraq wars cost us, and we have nothing to show for it now but a continual battle with ISIS and total instability in the Middle East, to where war can break out all over anytime, anywhere over there, thanks to what we've done. And spent all that money down that rat hole when we could have finished half of our infrastructure with the money that we spent down that rat hole called the war in Iraq. Thank you, George Bush. Thank you, Dick Cheney, for making a wonderful decision. It sucked.
Well, the engineers rated our energy infrastructure at a D+ as well, stating, "America relies on an aging electrical grid and pipeline distribution system, some of which originated in the 1880s. The availability of energy in the form of electricity, natural gas, and oil will become a greater challenge after 2020 as the population increases." So we're up against the ropes on this issue no matter what. Is the easy answer ever the right one? I mean, Keystone and their investors are ready to move. Should we keep investing in the short term and put off the long term effects?
No, we should not, because the long term effects will be devastating. It's time now to end our dependence on oil and take money and go to new energy sources that are clean and for the future. Look ahead, not behind. Oil is in the rearview mirror. You need to be looking ahead on the highway, not in the rearview mirror on something that you've already passed by.
Well, Hillary Clinton agrees with you on that point, as she's released her plan to update our infrastructure to be based in sustainable energy solutions. Among the things Clinton proposed, a North American climate compact between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, intended to create strong national targets and accountability mechanisms for emission reductions, modernizing the outdated oil pipeline system, increasing rail safety, and a national infrastructure bank to, quote, leverage public and private capital to invest in critically important infrastructure projects. The only thing...
Yeah, but wait a minute. How are we going to do this, though, and fight the wars? When is Hillary going to come out and say, get us out of the Middle East once and for all? When is any one of these candidates going to do that? How are you going to pay for all this and pay for the wars that we're fighting over in the Middle East when these bombers and bombs cost us millions and billions of dollars a day?
Right, and the only thing missing from her plan are specific job solutions. So there's not even a notion that they could create capital. And it sounds like she's heading in this right direction, but where are the actual jobs? Where's the actual income?
Yeah, and how are you going to pay for it? We're so far in debt right now, every person in the country owes 50 grand or whatever the hell it is. Where are we going to get the money to do all of this for our own country, the United States of America, as long as we continue with this same ridiculous colonialism superpower throughout the world? How are we going to do it and take care of all that? We're doing what Rome did. Guess what? Rome failed. That's all for this week's edition.
Well, Governor, yeah, I think you need to get back in the ring. You sound pretty good shape. Well, Jesse, I got to tell you, I talked about this stuff 2 or 3 years ago, this pipeline shit. I've been talking about this stuff 2 or 3 years, and now all of a sudden everybody's getting all excited about it. As far as trusting anything that Hillary Clinton says she's going to do, or actually any of the Republicans either, forget it. They get in there and then they don't do it. And, you know, look at Ronald Reagan and his Simpson-Mazzoli bill way back in the 80s, going to move millions of Mexicans out of the country. They passed it, made it a law that they... It would fine and jail corporation heads for hiring illegal aliens. Did anybody get arrested? No. Did any corporation head go to jail? No. It's all bullshit. This thing's going down, and there's nothing going to stop it. Too bad. I ain't for it going down, but it's going down. Every once in a while you hear about Mayor Daley of Chicago back in the old days. Not this recent, his son, but the old man. And they used to say how horrible and how crooked he was and all that kind of stuff. But he did know how to handle the black folk, I'll tell you that. He built those high-rise incubators to get them out of the way and stuff like that. But anyhow, the word I got, he lived in the same house for most of his life. And he didn't live in any big mansion. And the word I got was that he wasn't really on the take. About everybody else in Chicago was on the take. But my information was that the old man Daley was pretty straight. I'm going to play a show here. It's about a half an hour. And it's called Crosstalk. It's on RA or RT. It's very good. And it gives the European position and the Russian position quite well. And a lot of other people in the Middle East. This show was extremely interesting because we had three people who knew what the hell they were talking about, and the fourth one was a lying son of a bitch, Posner the Jew. So I thought it would be very interesting for you to hear what comes up on this show.
Welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. When it comes to mass migration and the current refugee crisis hitting the EU, it is getting harder and harder to remain an idealist. The reality is Europe must not only manage its external borders, but also internal ones. There are, of course, economic issues to deal with, but what about the importance of culture? Crisis. I'm joined by my guest, Markus Papadopoulos in London. He's the editor of Politics First magazine. Also in London, we have Matthew Goodwin. He's an expert in European politics from the University of Kent and Chatham House. And in Berlin, we cross to Alan Posner. He is an author and commentator for the newspaper Die Welt. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules. In fact, that means you can jump in anytime you want, and I very much encourage it. Markus, if I can go to you first in London, quite a few things in play right now. We read that 80,000 asylum seekers are being thrown out of Sweden. The U.S. is considering sending boots and bombs back to Libya after its quote-unquote wonderful success there. And then we have German ministers talking about paying refugees from Syria, for example, that maybe could be in Jordan, paying them to stay there, giving them a job so they don't go to Europe. I mean, what is this? Push, pull? I don't see any coherent script whatsoever to deal with something that is a very serious issue for Europe, and that's uncontrolled mass migration. And it's only going to get worse considering the way things are going right now. Go ahead, Markus in London.
One thing is for sure is that the EU's handling of the refugee crisis has been an absolute catastrophic disaster. A catastrophic disaster for the security of Europe and also for the values and culture of Europe. If I can pick up on the latter point, New Year's Eve in Cologne, over 150 women were sexually assaulted, and the police stood by and did nothing out of political correctness. The mayor of Cologne, a few days later, she made a dreadful comment about women dressing in an appropriate way to fend off possible attackers. And I didn't hear any feminist groups in Europe condemn what happened in Cologne on New Year's Eve. And then if I can pick up on the security point of view, you know, so many of us have been saying this for years and years and years, that the day the West meddled in Libya and in Syria and in Iraq, these sort of things were going to happen. And, you know, for anyone who argues that the migration crisis is not because of Western intervention in Libya and Syria and in Iraq, well, I would pose this question to them. Prior to the intervention in Iraq, how many refugees were leaving Iraq? Prior to the intervention in Libya, how many refugees were leaving Libya? Prior to the intervention in Syria, how many refugees were leaving Syria? And that is the crux of the refugee crisis, which is engulfing Europe at the moment. But do you know something, Peter? There's not going to be a remedy for this. Why? Because, for example, in Britain, British mainstream journalists, British politicians, they are not identifying the root of this, or the root cause of this. And the root cause, of course, is Western intervention. It's no different to someone who has been diagnosed with an illness because of their lifestyle, and that lifestyle is not being addressed. Well, how's that person ever going to get better if the root cause of this illness that the person has is their lifestyle? And it is exactly the same for Europe, and these problems will keep on coming and coming and coming in the future, because the West simply will not recognise that it is the root cause for the security threat in Europe and also in the wider world.
Okay, all right, look, Alan, you wanted to jump in there. You were reacting to what Markus is saying there. Please go ahead. That's the point of the programme. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is so stupid that I don't even know where to begin. I mean, why aren't all these refugees going to Russia then? They're not coming to Europe because we intervened in their societies and broke something that was so terribly, incredibly good. They're coming to Europe because Europe is an incredibly attractive model for living everywhere in the world.
Let me correct you there. They're not coming to Russia because Russia controls its borders. Russia controls its borders. That's a simple answer to your... That's a ridiculous comment to make. On top of it, Russia already took over 1 million refugees from Ukraine, okay? And they haven't been crying about it, all right? So Russia can...
You created 2 million refugees from Ukraine.
So
the EU, on February 22nd, had
an agreement with the Yanukovych government for political transition. Then on the next day, there was an arms coup that overthrew a democratically elected president. And the European Union did what? Nothing. cowardice.
You didn't.
Pure
you don't. You don't
cowardice
control,
on the part of the European Union,
borders.
And you see
you,
the same kind
you,
of cowardice
you,
dealing
oh,
with the refugee
talk,
crisis
right?
in Europe.
Me. Okay, well, just go
all right,
on.
You want to
go
shout at me? I can
me.
Shout equally
listening.
Back at you. All right, Matthew, you want to weigh in? Let's go to our third guest. Out of respect, go ahead.
You invited
Matthew,
me on the
ahead.
Program. You want me to talk? You let me talk, right?
Don't talk
you
rubbish.
Invited
Let's
me on
go
the
to
program.
Matthew first.
You didn't say anything.
Let's go to Matthew first. No, everything you said was wrong. Let's go to Matthew to see
well,
what he
you
has
invited
to say.
Me on because
well,
I talk rubbish.
Let's see what Matthew has
is
to
this
say.
Free
and
media?
Stop hogging time.
This is what
time.
Russia. This is
Don't
what Russian free media is like.
To everyone.
I think
You're
everyone
being
in Russia needs to see what free media is like.
Or just leave if you can't be courteous to other people. Go ahead, Matthew.
I'm courteous to anyone.
Okay, well,
go ahead.
Well, thanks for giving me the floor. I mean, I think the refugee challenge is a massive one for Europe, and I do certainly think that Europe's leaders have underestimated the scale of the challenge. And I think I would agree with some of the comments from Marcus there that they've misdiagnosed the what you might call the push factors, what's pushing people to leave their home states. And the issue here, I think, that worries most people is actually a failure by European elites to grasp and also understand public opinion on this issue. So Angela Merkel, you know, with the famous "We can do this" speech, essentially assume leadership of this issue. But if you look at the views of ordinary people in Europe, they are quite different from those stances that have been taken by the EU elite. And Merkel now, I think, is understanding that. In Sweden, we've seen quite a prominent backlash. The centre-left has collapsed in Sweden. Voters are moving over to the Sweden Democrats. In the UK, voters have been very firmly against the idea of accepting more refugees. And in France and Austria, we've seen very high levels of support for political parties that are completely opposed to any further immigration, not just refugees. So seen through the prism of public opinion, I think there's a very clear trend in Europe that is not really being adequately acknowledged by leaders.
Yeah, but Marcus, at the same time, you still have different capitals in Europe continuing want to intervention in Middle East countries. I mean, I mentioned Libya there. I mean, as we speak right now, the Pentagon is working on a plan to re-intervene into Libya after everything that has been done. We didn't have a massive refugee crisis in Libya before the forced regime change there. And now they want to try it again. They say, quote unquote, they're looking for reliable partners. I mean, how do you look for reliable partners in a failed state? Go ahead, Marcus.
Can I just say one quick thing,
sure.
Peter? It only took a few minutes for anti-Russian hysteria to emerge in this program. So
okay.
Congratulations to Alan in Berlin for that. But you know, this is the problem. You know, ever since
are you
gonna
the
let
me say something, or are you not?
Ever since the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union, you know, the West has brought so much carnage to the world because they saw an opportunity in the 1990s to dominate the world politically, economically, and militarily. And they took advantage of Russia being on its knees during the 1990s. They wrecked Yugoslavia. They brought jihadists into Bosnia to fight the Bosnian Serbs. They went into Iraq, and by going into Iraq, they in effect gave birth to ISIS. And then in Libya, whatever people thought of Muammar Gaddafi and his policies, he was the leader of an independent sovereign country, and he kept Islamist terrorists out of Libya. And now they've gone into Syria, and Syria is the most progressive Arab country in the world. It is modern, it is secular, it is multicultural, and it is virtually destroyed that, though of course I'm very hopeful that Syria is going to recover through Russian military assistance. But as I said earlier on in the program, the problem is this, is that the West continues to behave in this malignant way, and then it blames others in the world for the crises that it actually causes. For example, the Ukraine crisis has been blamed on Russia. The situation in Syria is being blamed on Russia. No, it is the West. It is the West acting under this pretext of humanitarian intervention, which is giving rise to the refugee crisis, which is giving rise to Islamic extremism and Islamic terrorism. And there's no end in the future
Let me address that to Alan. What is the sense of causation here? I mean, Western interventions have nothing to do with this refugee and migration crisis in Europe. They're not connected in your mind, correct?
No, absolutely. If anything, the problem is not that we intervened, but that we left too soon. Firstly, talking about Libya, we're basically having no refugees from Libya at the moment. Then talk about where the refugees are coming from. They're coming, for instance, from Pakistan, where there's no Western intervention. They're coming from Iraq since the West has left Iraq, which was admittedly a terrible mistake. They're coming from Afghanistan after the West has said that they're leaving our friends in the lurch, leaving Afghanistan. Are you going to let me talk the way you let? Are you going to let me talk the way you left?
No, I'm asking you. I asked a question.
Are you going to let me talk?
Do you think it was a mistake?
Are you going
to
let me talk?
Do you think it was a good idea to invade Iraq in the first place? Do you think that was a good idea?
It was a very good idea to invade Iraq in the first place. It was necessary.
Based on what criteria?
It was necessary to deal with a dictator who gassed his own people.
Who gave him the chemical weapons to gas the United States?
Why can't I state my views? I thought I was invited on this program to state my views. If you don't want to hear my views, if you just scream at me, you're not going
to
hear them. Is this what free media is about?
We can go to the State Department and get the same talking points. You're not adding any value to this conversation
whatsoever. No value at all. You're absolutely
okay. The United States illegally invaded a country. You can't even respect international law.
Because
that's amazing. Only the West doesn't respect international law. It's rich for a country which invaded Ukraine.
What day did Russia invade Ukraine?
When did that happen, Alan? When? Give me a date. When did that happen?
2 years ago.
When? 2 years ago. What day?
When you invaded Crimea. You don't even remember that? That's so long ago.
No, no, no. There were already 25,000 troops there legally under international law. You don't even know what you're talking about, Alan.
That is true.
You don't know what you're talking
Alan,
about.
Alan, I think you should go to the Crimea and say that Russia invaded the Crimea.
This is, all right, I have to jump in here.
Gentlemen, we have a long way to go still. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion.
For All Things Are Considered, I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Europe's refugee and migrant crisis. To go back to you in London, one of the, at least for the EU, I think one of the things they think is one of the great accomplishments of the European experiment is that not to have any kind of internal borders and actually loose external borders here. Do you think that this is, for a lot of people now, this is a crisis of sovereignty? The countries don't have control of who can walk in and out of them. And okay, Germany wants, at least it's on the record, wanting a lot of refugees, but most countries, particularly in Eastern Europe, feel very overwhelmed by having a lot of refugees from the Middle East. There are countries like Poland that will cite cultural reasons. They don't want to have a lot of Muslims among themselves because they call themselves a Catholic country, for example. And then you have other countries like Greece that is completely defenseless right now. It has to deal with so many problems. And now with hundreds of thousands of people possibly walking through, that cannot be a good way for a country to exist. I mean, is this one of the things Europe is going to really seriously re-examine? Because it's when you see hordes of people walking through your streets, it can be quite frightful. Go ahead.
Well, here's my concern, Peter. What's the plan? What's the long-term plan for dealing with this? I was at an event just a week ago where it was estimated that another 1.1 million refugees will be arriving or heading to Germany in 2016 on top of the 1.1 million refugees in 2015. And less than 10% of those refugees so far have actually been integrated into any aspect of the labour market. Okay, so what's the long-term plan? And then when you look at European states and you contrast, for example, Hungary with the UK, with Germany, or with Sweden, they are very different views as to how this crisis should be dealt. In the UK, David Cameron's been very restrictive. Arguably, he's actually understood where public opinion is. He said 20,000 refugees over 5 years, and this week has accepted some unaccompanied children from Syria, from the camps in Syria. But other states, notably Germany and in earlier times Sweden, basically took a far more liberal approach, saying anybody and everybody can come in, which was at odds with where I think public opinion was and what the actual people wanted. And that's a real problem for Europe here, Peter, because many voters really feel that things like national identity, values, national culture are incredibly important to them. That it isn't just about jobs and resources. Yeah. And the real issue here is that I think European leaders are failing to acknowledge the power of that national identity. And that's a real challenge for Europe because too often the EU has seemed disconnected from grassroots opinion.
Yeah, Marcus, again, it's this kind of democracy deficit. You know, only Brussels knows better, or actually Berlin is an extension. They know what's best for the entire European Union. I mean, Angela Merkel's behavior in all of this is just quite remarkable. It's galling how she could ask for so many people to, you know, traipse their way all the way to Germany. What do you think, they were all going to fly there? Oh, my goodness here. I mean, this is a completely irresponsible, and it's certainly damaging to the entire European experiment. I mean, again, I've always criticized it for taking away so much sovereignty from these countries. You can't control your borders. This is what you get.
Well, the European Union projects itself to the world as a beacon of democracy. However, when it comes to matters such as immigration and the refugee crisis, the views of ordinary people across the European Union are being either sidelined or they're being denigrated as being the views of racist people, yeah. Which is absolute nonsense. And quite frankly, it's very, very disrespectful. You know, many people, for example, in Britain, they are concerned about the refugee crisis, not because they're racist, far from it. They feel threatened from an economic perspective, a cultural perspective, and also from a security perspective. And recently, Interpol announced its findings of an investigation, and Interpol clearly stated that thousands upon thousands of refugees are actually not refugees, but they are actually potential terrorists. So when people in Britain, for example, express concerns over the refugee crisis, they should not be denigrated as racist or sidelined. There is nothing wrong with people who are genuinely concerned about their culture and about their economic prosperity and about their security. You know, of course, some people are going to be racist. They're going to be neo-Nazis. And quite frankly, these people should just be ignored. But the vast majority of people in Britain, they are concerned for legitimate reasons. And if the EU wants to maintain this idea it has that it's a beacon of democracy in the world, but it should start listening to the concerns of the ordinary man and woman across the whole union.
Alan, how do you square Germany's position with this issue with the other countries of the European Union? Because it's very much at odds with your neighbors.
I'd like to say one thing about the Schengen zone, no passports. You used to enjoy, when the Soviet Union existed, traveling from, shall we say, Riga in the north to Yerevan in the south in Armenia without having to show a passport. And we enjoy traveling from Riga in the north to Naples in the south without showing our passport. And we're not going to give up on that just because we have a refugee crisis at the moment. We may have to, for a time, reintroduce border controls, but we want to get back to where we were. And I think many people in Russia think back with nostalgia to that time when they could travel as freely.
I don't think so.
The Soviet Union was a country.
And the second thing is,
Alan, the European Union
that's becoming the Soviet Union. That's what's happening here.
May I continue?
Alan, that's illogical. Alan, what you've said is illogical. The Soviet Union was a country. The European Union is not a country.
And I'd like to go on with that. If you let me talk. No one is forcing, for instance, Poland to take more refugees. Germany took 1 million refugees, and actually 500,000 of those refugees, one half were not, and they're going to be sent back sooner or later. Poland hasn't been forced to take any, nor has Hungary, nor has Slovakia, nor has the Czech Republic. Nor has Great Britain. Nobody can force a sovereign country within the European Union to take more refugees than they want. And this is not happening.
Are they going to keep going there?
We have to respect. Sorry?
Are they going to keep going there? Wave after wave after wave you're going to accept in Germany?
No, I don't think that cannot happen. It's obvious that Germany's capacity for absorbing migrants is limited, just as is the capacity of every other European country. Now, whether you set that limit at, shall we say, 200,000 a year, as the Bavarians are suggesting, or 500,000 a year, as I think Merkel's plan is, or whether you say it's 20,000, as Mr. Cameron does, or whether you say the Poles, they don't want to take anyone, that is a question for every country to sort out for itself, and it will be and must be sorted out. And we are at the moment engaged in large programs of deportation of people back to countries, including, by the way, Afghanistan, where they came from, because they do not have a legitimate Refugee status. It's simply irresponsible to claim
that
Germany
that,
is letting everyone in who wants to come. That's not the case.
Okay.
Sorry?
That's not the case.
I mean, it has been claiming
has nothing to do with this. That's the position coming out of Berlin here. Let me go to Marcus here. I think, Marcus, I'd like to react to something that Alan said right now. Today in Russia, and I've lived here for 18 years, they do like having sovereign borders of the Russian Federation. They don't want people from the former Soviet republics traipsing into Russia. They want to have passport control, and they want to make sure they know where people are. Why? For security reasons, to control your sovereignty. And all of these countries are doing exactly the same thing. Now, believe me, everybody walking from Kazakhstan into Moscow is not going to happen because it's against the immigration rules and laws here. Alan, you're living in an illusory world, okay? You have no idea what it means living in Russia.
Well, let
here,
me say okay? something. Let me say something about security, if I may. May I say something about security? The fact is that having a passport control at the border has nothing to do with security or not security. We all know, and you know very well in Russia, that the big criminals, the control people who control the mafia and so on, they don't only have one passport. They have two passports. They have three passports. The people who killed Mr. Litvinenko in the EU country Great Britain, Matthew and Marcus. They had passports, Russian passports, by the way. And the people who come in illegally, they don't have any passports. So whether you have a passport control or not, you're not going to get them. I mean, so the fact is that this whole idea about we need borders for security reasons is just a lie. It's not true.
So, there's no immigration problem. There's no security problem. Everything's just hunky-dory, right, Alan? I mean, I don't know what world you live in.
I didn't say everything was hunky-dory.
It's amazing.
I didn't say we are cooperating strongly with our French, British, and other counterparts to control people, because there is a security aspect to this.
Yeah.
Of course there is.
That's
we know very well.
That's what happened in Paris,
and
right,
where do you
Alan?
Get this?
That's what happened in Paris. You control everything.
These were
right.
not...
Okay. Matthew, you want to jump in there?
Yeah, so what happened in...
I have a simple question. Alan, I have a simple question, though. How can Germany actually stop the inflows without giving up on Schengen? How does Germany resolve this issue in a Europe with Schengen? I can't see how those two are compatible. Borders are already going up. Inflows will continue to arrive.
How does
the Schengen agreement survive? You tell me. What's the answer?
The answer to that is Greece has to protect its border to Turkey. Greece has one of the biggest navies in the whole European Union, and it's doing zilch to protect its borders against Turkey. Now, I understand why the Greeks are doing that, because they were mistreated by Germany, by Angela Merkel, during the economic crisis, and they're getting their own back. But they have to pull their act together.
Oh, you're blaming Greece now for it.
Bulgaria has put up fence... Sorry?
Alan, you live in cloud cuckoo.
Go ahead, Matthew.
This is what I was saying earlier on. There's no long-term plan. There is no long-term plan in Europe for resolving this, because too many states think too differently about this issue. They've all got grievances. They're thinking very differently.
This
it's very difficult
problem,
for the EU.
Yep. Absolutely. This is a real problem.
You're openly saying, Alan, that Merkel should never have stood up and said,
Merkel
should
never
have stood up and taken the position that she said.
All right, gentlemen, this was a very lively edition of the program. Many thanks to my guests in London and in Berlin, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RTC.
Well, that was a hot session. Yeah, I like that show. There's several shows on Russia Today that you should try to get if you can, because you get around the State Department bullshit and American corporation bullshit media that lie through their nose, I'm telling you. But on some of these kind of shows, you get what's going on. And here's the thing. The Americans won't accept the fact that the Pentagon and George Bush, Cheney, and all these people caused this whole goddamn thing. And these Republicans are running around in total denial. and even a lot of the Democrats that were hawks, they're in denial. Oh, we caused this? Oh, well, you mean just by invading the country and wiping out their governments? You know, first Saddam Hussein and then the rest of these people and want to run, destroy all of them. And then the people going to run for cover? Well, of course they're going to run for cover. And now that's how this whole thing... Well, anyhow, I've been talking about it for quite a while. But you don't hear hardly any of it on the right-wing radio stations. And as far as the right-wing racial bunch, they can't think that deep at all. So you can't find it there with most of them. I'll be straight out with you. We got to dump this goddamn corporate capitalism, predatory capitalism. We got to dump it before it destroys us all. And I'll debate any of these guys on that subject. And on another subject, too, similar, bringing all this non-white workforce in the United States. Who brought these black people in here in the first place? Who brought it in? Not the working class. It was the ruling class, the upper class, the rich. They brought them in. Who brought the Chinese in from China back in the early part of the 19th century, last part of the 18th century? Who brought them in? The guys that owned the steamships, the big millionaires, billionaires brought them in. In every case that we've got a major problem racially in this country, I can put the upper class rich bastards at the heart of it. Every one of them. Now, sure, there's plenty of white people went along with it. Of course, there's plenty of people go along with anything. But the cause of the problem is in the predatory capitalism and those people who all they want is profit and they don't give a shit. I mean, you know, the Republicans cry about our jobs. Nixon's opened it up. When he went to China way back there. I've told you that over and over again. These guys, they're insane. And the trouble is, the working class tend to go along with them. All they have to do is talk about abortion or, you know, a few of these other things. And, oh, these are our heroes. These are not our heroes. These are sons of bitches that need to be dealt with at some point. And I mean dealt with. An interesting thing here is Bernie Sanders is a Jew, okay? Bernie Sanders has been a senator for quite a while, but on some issues, he's right. And as far as his defense of the working class, he's 100% right. He's right about a lot of this stuff. And, of course, the right wing are all saying, well, he's a socialist. They don't say he's a Jew, but they say he's a socialist. So what? Two-thirds of this country is running on socialism right now. I mean, the military is the number one socialist outfit. But all the stuff in this country, Social Security, Medicare, well, hell, I can't count all the programs that are socialist. But yet these Republican right-wingers will say, oh, you can't, that's socialism. We can't have socialism. They got goddamn lying bastards. Pardon me, but I get pissed off, man. And now we're going to have this stupid, ignorant, bullshit thing in Iowa tonight. And it don't mean a thing. All these white people getting all excited. Oh, my God, yeah, well, Trump's going to straighten it out. The ruling class are not going to straighten out anything. It's got to be the people, the working class, to rise up and straighten it out. That's the only thing that'll straighten it out. If it can be straightened out, it may be totally too late to straighten out. And I don't blame any country in the Middle East or any country in Europe or any country anywhere for hating the United States government. And because they're the government over us, then the people of these countries blame you and me. And well, we don't stand up and argue and fight about it. What do you expect? We deserve to be hated. And it was amusing to hear even some of these guys are pretty good guys on that show yapping about racism. racism. Well, look, what they're advocating is exactly what I advocate, separation. National separation, racial separation, cultural separation. That's what works. But they try to get off the, they try to get out of the limelight by saying, well, we're not like those racists. Well, I don't know what I'm saying that they're not saying. I'm saying the same thing. But we're bad. They're bad. They're good. But I'm going to tell you, as time goes on, those masses of people are not going to give a shit. They're just going to go. And you can call them racist all you want, but they're going to hang you from a lamppost. Now I'm going to read from a book from 1888 called The Aryan Race. Yeah, that's going back quite a ways. We got a little time left in the show here. It is our purpose briefly to outline the history of the Aryan race, that great and noble family of mankind which has played so striking a part upon the stage of the world. To seek it in its primitive home, observe the unfoldment of its beliefs and institutions, follow it in its migrations, consider the features of its intellectual supremacy, and trace the steps by which it has gained its present high position among the races of mankind. The story of this people, despite the great interest which surrounds it, remains unwritten in any complete sense. There are many books, indeed, which deal with it fragmentarily, some devoted to its languages, others to its mythology, folklore, village communities, or to some other singular aspect of its many-sided story. Yet no general treatment of the subject has been essayed, and the inquirer who wishes to learn what is known of this interesting people must painfully delve through a score of volumes to gain the desired information. Until within a recent period of actual existence of such a race was not clearly recognized. Hold it. A century ago, there was nothing to show that nearly all the nations of Europe and the most prominent of those of Southern Asia were first cousins descended from a singular ancestor, which not very remotely in the past inhabited a contracted locality in some regions yet unknown. Of late years, much has been learned of the conditions and the mode of life of this people in their original home, and of their migrations to the point where they enter the field of written history. From this point forward, the part played by the Aryans in the history of mankind has been a highly important one, and there is no more interesting study than to follow this giant from the days of its childhood to those of its present imposing stature. Our knowledge of the condition of the primitive Aryans is not due only to studies of philology. The subject was widened by the progress of research and new embraces questions of ethnology, archaeology, mythology, literature, social and political antiquities, and all the other branches of science which relate particularly to the development of mankind. Enough has been learned through the studies in these several directions to make desirable a general treatment of the subject and an effort to present as a whole the story that mighty race, whose history is as yet known to the world only in disconnected fragments. The present work, however, pretends to be no more than a preliminary handling of this extensive theme. A brief popular exposition, which may serve to fill a gap in the realm of literature and to satisfy the curiosity of the reading world until some abler hand shall grasp the subject and deal with it in a more exhaustive manner. Any attempt, indeed, to tell the story of the Aryan race, even in outline, during the recent age of mankind, would be equivalent to an attempt to write the history of civilization, which is far from our purpose. But in the comparison of the intellectual conditions and products of the several races of mankind, and in the consideration of the evolution of human institutions and lines of thought and action, we have a field of research which is by no means exhausted, and with which the general world of readers is very little conversant. Our work will therefore be found to be largely comparative in treatment. The characteristics and conditions of other leading races of mankind being considered and contrasted with those of the Aryan, with the purpose not only of the clearly showing the general superiority of the latter, but also of pointing out the natural steps of evolution through which it emerged from the original savagery and attained to its present intellectual supremacy and advanced stage of enlightenment. As regards the sources of the information conveyed in the following pages, we shall but say that all the statements concerning the question of fact have been drawn from trustworthy authors, many of whom are quoted in the text, though it has not been deemed necessary to crowd the pages with citations of authorities. In respect to the theatrical views advanced, they are the rule of the author's own and must stand or fall on their merits. Finally, it is hoped that the work may prove of interest and value to those who simply desire general knowledge of the subject, and may in some measure serve as a guide to those more ardent students who prefer to continue the study by consultation of original authorities. Types of mankind. Somewhere, no man can say just where, at the same time it is equally impossible to say when, there dwelt in Europe or Asia a most remarkable tribe or people or family of mankind. Where or when this was, we shall never clearly know. No history mentions their name or gives a hint to their existence. No legend or tradition has floated down to us from the vanished realm of life. Not a monument remains which we can distinguish as reared by the hands of this people. Not even the grave of one of the members can be traced. Flourishing civilizations were even then in existence. Egypt and China were already the seats of busy life and native thought. Yet no prophet of these nations saw the cloud on the sky of the size of the man's hand, a cloud destined to grow until its mighty shadow should cover the whole face of the earth. As yet the fathers of the Aryan race dwelt in the unconsidered barbarism, living their simple lives and thinking their simple thoughts, of no more apparent importance than the hundreds of other primeval tribes, and doubtless undreaming of the grand part that they were yet to play in the drama of human history. Yet strangely enough, this utterly prehistoric and anti-legendary race, this dead scion of the dead past, has been raised from its grave and displayed in the ancient shape before the eyes of man. Until we know its history as satisfactory as we know that of many peoples yet living upon the face of the earth, we may not know its time or place of existence, the battles it fought, the heroes it honored, the songs it sang, but we know the words it spoke, the gods it worshipped, the laws it made, We know the character of its industries and its possessions, its family and political relations, its religious ideas and the conditions of its intellectual development, its race characteristics, and much of the details of its grand migrations after its growing numbers swelled beyond the boundaries of their ancestral home and went forth to conquer and possess the earth. How we have learned all these forms one of the most interesting chapters in modern history, modern science. The reality of our knowledge cannot be questioned. No history is half so trustworthy. Into all written history, innumerable errors creep, but that the unconscious history which survives in the languages and institutions of mankind is, so far as it goes, of indisputable authenticity. It is not indeed history of its ordinary sense. It yields us none of the superficial and individual details in the story of the people's life, the deeds of the warriors and the tyrannies of the rulers and the conquests of rebellions and strong class struggles, the names and systems of the priests and lawgivers with which historians usually deal, and which they weave into a web of inextricable mingling truth and falsehood. It is the rock bed of history with which we are here convinced or concerned, the solid foundation on which superficial edifice is built. We know nothing of the deeds of this antique race. We are ignorant of the number of its people and the location and the extent of its territory, the period of its development, but we know much of its basal history, that history which has wrought itself deeply into the language, customs, beliefs, and institutions of its modern descendants, and which crops out everywhere through the soil of modern European civilization as the granite foundations of the earth's strata break through the superficial layers and reveals the conditions of the remote past. Such a germinal history of a people may very possibly lack interest. It has in it nothing of the dramatic, nothing on which the imagination can seize, none of those personal details of stirring incidents which so strongly arrest the attention of readers, nothing to arouse the feelings or awaken the passions and emotions of mankind. It has none of the ever alluring interest of the individual human life. The hopes and fears and joys and sorrows and sayings and doings of men, great and small, which give to the gossipy details of history an attractiveness only a degree below that of an imaginary novel. Over our work, we can cast none of the glamour of individualism. We have to do with man in the mass, and to treat history as a philosophy instead of a romance. We are limited to the description of what he has done, not how he did it, and to the detail of results instead of process. And yet history in its modern era is rapidly entering this philosophic age. For many centuries, it has been confined to the romance of individual life. It is now verging toward the philosophy of existence, the scientific study of human development. King and courtiers have too long dwarfed the people, but the nature and stature of people is interesting, and that of rulers and heroes diminishing, while a growing interest in the story of humanity as a whole is succeeding that in the lives of individuals. This gives us warrant for venturing to describe the history of a race whose ancient life we know only as a whole, and of which we cannot give the name of one of its heroes, the scene of one of its exploits, or even the region of the earth which it occupied. Yet this race is so important a one that later history has been so grand and exciting that the story of what is known of its primitive life can scarcely fail to find an interested audience, particularly when we remember that we are here dealing with our own ancestors and tracing the pedigrees of our own customs and institutions. In this inquiry, it is necessary to begin by considering the claim of the Aryans to the title of race. What position do they hold in the category of human races, and what were the steps of their migration, derivation, and development from primitive man? We must locate them first as members of the broad family of mankind before we can fairly enter into the study of their record as a separate group. We've spoken of them somewhat indefinitely as a race, family, or tribe. Indeed, they cannot justly be honored with the title of race until we know more fully in what the race characteristic consists of and what is their claim to its possession. In this respect, ethnologists have so many varying ideas that the number and limitations of the human races are still far from being settled. We can therefore but briefly detail some of the latest views upon the subject. Race divisions, indeed, have been made through two widely different lines of research. Of these, the first and most fundamental is the physical characteristics. The second is that of linguistic conditions. The latter, based on the radical diversities of human languages, doubtlessly indicates a more recent separation of mankind. To a considerable extent, it follows the lines of physical variation. It seldom crosses these lines to any important extent, though it separates some of the broad physical divisions into minor races. The Aryan is one of these linguistic races. It is not a true race in the wider sense, since, as it presently constituted, it includes the portion of two physical groups which have so intimately intermingled that the pure specimens of either are somewhat exceptional and are found in any considerable number only on the opposite borderlands of these groups. The primary separation of mankind's races very long preceded the development of modern families of languages and was due to strictly physical influences. The mental lines of division, as indicated by language, are much more recent. The physical races have made variously classified by ethnologists, one of the latest schemes being that of Professor Huxley, who distinguishes four principal types of man: the Mongoloid, the Negro, the Australoid, and the Anxothroic, which I've never heard of, to which he adds a fifth variety, the Melanocabral, which I have never heard of. It is only with the last two of these that we are here directly concerned, since it is these which enter into the composition of the Aryan race. More recently, Professor Flower has given an outline on a system of human classifications which he regards as most in accordance with the present state of our knowledge of the subject. He considers that there are three extreme types, those called the Blumenbach, the Ethiopian, and the Mongolian, and the Caucasian, around which all existing individual of human species can be ranged, but between which every possible intermediate form can be found. Of these, the Ethiopian is secondarily divided into the African Negroes, the Hottentots, the Bushmen, the Oceanic Negroes, and the Melanesians, and the Negritos, also represented by the inhabitants of Andaman and other Pacific islands. The Australians, whom Huxley takes as the type of separate race, he considers to be a mixed people, as they combine the Negro type of face and skeleton with the hair of a different type. His second race is the Mongolian, represented in an exaggerated form by the Eskimo, in its typical condition by most of the natives of northern and eastern Asia, and in a modified type by the Malays. Excluding the Eskimo, the Americans formed one group whose closest affinity is with the Mongolian, yet which has so much special features that it might be viewed as a fourth primary division. His third, or Caucasian race, includes two subraces, the Anthocroic and the Melanchroic of Huxley. The seat of this race is Europe, northern Africa, and southwestern Asia, its linguistic division being into Aryans, Semites, and Hamites. Several recent writers are inclined to accept a conclusion closely similar to that of Professor Flower, and to divide man into three typical races, the Negro, the Mongoloid, and the Caucasian, or the Mediterranean, viewing all remaining races as secondary derivatives of these. As, for instance, the American and the Malay from the Mongolian, or as mixtures, as the Australians from the combination of Oceanic Mongoloids and Negroes. Topinard goes far to divide man into three distinct species. The first of these is the Mongolian, distinguished by branchipetlik, or short skull, by low stature, yellowish skin, broad, flat countenance, bleak eyes, contracted eyelids, beardless face, hair scanty, coarse, and round in section. The second is the Caucasian, with moderately dysceletic, I can't pronounce that word, or long skull, tall stature, fair, narrow face, projecting on the medium line, hair and beard abundant, light colored and soft, and somewhat elliptical in section. His third species is the Negro, with skull strongly dolichophyllic, complexion black, hair flat and rolled into spirals, face very prognathous, and with several peculiarities of body structure not necessarily to name here. It is not our purpose to express any opinion upon this theory of specific differences in mankind, except to say that if such differences exist, they are probably limited to the Negro and the Mongoloid stock. There are good reasons for removing the Caucasian from this category. That the Negroes and the Mongolians do differ in sufficient particulars of structure to constitute a specific difference in the lower animals must be admitted. Well, that's it, enough for today. Maybe we'll get into that a little more tomorrow. I don't know. You guys don't tell me too often what books you like for me to read from, so I just sort of pick them up and go with them, huh? How about that? Well, looking at our racial calendar, I see we have no birthdays until next week, or things that happen. Now, on February the 13th, coming up, 135,000 men, women, and children were killed in the blanket fire bombing of Dresden, Germany, a real Holocaust that's seldom talked about. Yeah. 14 words, 5 words. See you tomorrow.